drove a few blocks away and parked in a quiet spot on a nearby street. Time was short, but Tolkachev was firm. Exfiltration was out of the question. He gave the envelope with the exfiltration plan back to Morris. At the same time, Morris handed back to Tolkachev the sensitive materials he had provided at the March meeting on the MiG-29 target recognition system. This was a standard procedure, to return to Tolkachev any original written materials once the CIA had seen them. Tolkachev handed over 14 rolls of film, despite all his complaints of tight security. He told Morris he had circumvented the system. Details would be found in his 12-page ops note. "It is extremely difficult just to sit and not produce," he added. Morris was out of the car and on his way in 15 minutes. It soon became clear to the Moscow station that Tolkachev was taking more risks than ever. In his note, Tolkachev explained that in the early morning, doors to the laboratory were unlocked around 7:30, but actual work didn't get underway until about 8. For 5 minutes after the doors were unlocked, he said, no one was present. "This is what I took advantage of," he wrote. Even so, he had to bring the camera to work 3 times. "Since it was only on the 3rd time that I was able to get 5 minutes when nobody was in the lab." Tolkachev also described a ruse in which he had told others that a secret document was being examined by a supervisor at midday, but in fact he took it home to photograph. "This ruse, of course, is very risky," he acknowledged, "and it's not possible to use it more than 2 or 3 times. Tolkachev's note explained his change of heart about exfiltration. He and his wife had close friends who left for Israel and then for the United States, he said. They had written back that they were growing nostalgic for Moscow. Tolkachev quoted his own wife as saying, "How can people decide to leave to who knows where? As far as I am concerned, I know for sure that I would immediately begin to suffer from nostalgia. Not only could I not live in another country, but I couldn't even live in another city in the Soviet Union." Tolkachev added that his son might want to travel someday, but not leave permanently. "Therefore, the question about my leaving the Soviet Union with my family, for all practical purposes, is closed. Of course, I would never go alone." The Moscow station and headquarters debated for weeks how to respond to Tolkachev's letter. "We are deeply concerned," headquarters wrote on June 13th about the risks he was taking. "The ruses he told us about in his April note are frightening enough. Additional ploys, which he said he also used but fails to describe, may be even more alarming." Headquarters admitted that they were caught in a bind, one that had been evident since the early days of the operation. "How can we get CK's fear to control his risk-taking propensities and at the same time satisfy both his imperative to produce and our desire for his product?" Headquarters was leery about giving Tolkachev the small Tropel cameras, recalling that when he had used them in 1979 and 1980, the prints did not come out well because of insufficient light and poor technique. The light level in his office was only 20 foot candles, headquarters pointed out, barely enough for copying documents. Instead of cameras, wouldn't it be better to ask Tolkachev just to take notes of what was most important? Yet the CIA wanted it all. They wanted Tolkachev to be safe, but they wanted to pump out all the secrets they could. Headquarters passed along to the Moscow station a fresh list of topics to ask Tolkachev about. "The major systems of current interest to us," headquarters said, "are the TU-22M, TU-160, Yak-41, IFF systems, and major modifications to the Sapphire radar. Our first priority is for technical specifications, proposed or actual, on the above systems, or on any new electronic or weapon systems, including missiles. Other details on capabilities, function, and employment are also valuable, but may be lengthy. This spoke volumes about the state of the Tolkachev operation after 4 years. The Tu-22M and the Tu-160, known by NATO as the Backfire and the Blackjack, respectively, were supersonic strategic bombers, neither of which was directly in Tolkachev's line of work. Nor was the Yak-41, a vertical takeoff and landing aircraft that was never produced. The IFF, Identification Friend or Foe, and Sapphire radars were definitely within Fazatron's field of research, but Tolkachev had already provided extensive material on the Sapphire. Tolkachev was being pushed to grab secrets well beyond those that he would normally see at the office. The CIA wrestled with whether to give Tolkachev new miniature spy cameras for use at his office. The station pointed out that the small Tropel spy cameras had improved somewhat. The minimum light was now 25 foot candles. Headquarters was worried that sooner or later another Fazatron worker would see, one time too many, that Tolkachev was hunched over, elbows on his desk, hands clasping something, and grow suspicious. Tolkachev would have to do any photography in the presence of other people, headquarters cautioned. This, of course, is an extremely risky endeavor and would require tremendous discretion and caution by CK Sphere, and is not likely to help his blood pressure either. But headquarters gave in. The Tropel cameras would be sent to Moscow. Chapter 15. Not Caught Alive. In the morning on April 26, 1983, the head designer at the Institute, Yuri Kurpichev, called Tolkachev into his office to discuss some routine problems. Kurpichev was Tolkachev's superior. As they were talking, the phone rang. Kurpichev picked it up, and after several minutes of silence, asked the caller, "For what purpose do you need this?" Then he added, "Very well, I'll do it." The phone call had come from Nikolai Balan, head of the regime, the overarching security office at the Institute. The regime, which reported to the KGB, controlled the first department and secret library, and the clearance process for all workers. Every 10 years, each employee had to answer a lengthy questionnaire. The questionnaire was then sent to the KGB for review and decisions about who would get top secret clearance. Tolkachev had the highest level access. The regime also was responsible for guards and building passes. The regime existed in every secret Soviet enterprise. After the call, Kurpichev summoned the leading engineer at the Institute, who had worked on the target recognition system for the No. 19 radar that would go into the MiG-29 fighter. As Tolkachev listened, terrified, Kurpichev described the call. "By the end of the day," he said, "Balin wanted a list of persons familiar with the recognition system or having access to information about the recognition system with the RLS number 19. This was the information that Tolkachev had passed to the CIA in March. "For what is this needed?" asked the leading engineer, protesting that they had never been asked to compile such lists before. Kurpichev said he had asked the same question of Balan, who answered me with nothing that was intelligible. Tolkachev went back to his office, his head spinning. He felt paralyzed. He turned the conversation over and over in his mind, wondering whether he had been discovered. His first worry was about the handwritten notes on the target recognition system he had given the CIA. The notes had been returned to him. But had the CIA slipped up? Had someone else seen them? Tolkachev tried to come to grips with what he heard. If Balan was demanding a list of employees, that suggested a very serious leak of information about the target recognition system. But what did they know about the source? Did the KGB have a suspect? Or were they just fishing? He concluded that one possibility was that the KGB had no idea where the information had come from. Actually, There were dozens of potential sources, institutes in Moscow, including his own and several others, or aviation and electronics factories far away that built radars and parts for them, located in the cities of Kazan, Ryazan, and Khmelnytsky. In that case, it would take time to investigate. Another possibility, more ominous and frightening, was that they were closing in on him. If so, Tolkachev figured they would need only 1 or 2 days. By nightfall, the security office would already have a list of employees with access to the material. By the next day, the list would be sent to the KGB. If they had managed to intercept Tolkachev's papers given to the CIA, he had written the information by hand, then it would be a simple matter to compare the handwriting with his answers on the clearance questionnaire, also written out in hand. Anyone could do it in a few hours. His last clearance questionnaire was completed in 1980. Tolkachev made some hurried decisions. He would destroy everything the CIA had given him that could be incriminating, and he would not, under any circumstances, fall into the hands of the KGB, at least not alive. He told his supervisor he would not be coming to work the next day. He didn't say why. The next morning, April 27th, after his wife and son left the apartment, Tolkachev gathered up all the spy gear and materials hidden in the entresol, the Pentax cameras and clamp, the dead drop and signal instructions, the dissident books, the bricks of rubles, the discus, the shortwave radio demodulator, everything, including the L-pill and the schedule of future meetings. He loaded it all into the Ziguli and drove out of Moscow. There wasn't time to signal the CIA or ask for a meeting. He crossed the outer Moscow Ring Road and drove into the country, heading north on the Rogachevskoye Chaussee, or highway. Soon the metropolis of concrete and asphalt gave way to thick forests and open fields. He turned eastward off the highway onto a narrow road, then northeast onto another country road that after 5 miles took a slow, lazy curve, revealing a small rural village, Doronino. Only 6 houses stood by the road. One of them was a summer house, or dacha, that Tolkachev and his wife had leased in 1981. When they were younger, they traveled widely around the Soviet Union, backpacking and camping. But now that they had a car, the dacha made more sense. It was common for people in the city to acquire houses in half-abandoned villages and repair them. Property rights were highly questionable. Buying or selling a property was strictly forbidden. But there were other means. Tolkachev made a deal that was something like a lease. The houses were not expensive, but they demanded time and effort to fix up. Tolkachev searched for scarce construction materials and repaired the house himself, which he enjoyed. The house was about 50 miles from the city. An old iron stove stood in the center of the house. Tolkachev pulled the spy gear out of the Ziguli, fired up the stove, and burned everything, including the rubles the CIA had given him, the instructions, the books, the cameras, everything except for the meeting schedule and the suicide pill inside the fountain pen. When the fire cooled, Tolkachev realized that some metal parts from the discus had not burned. He gathered them up. As he drove back toward Moscow, he tossed the metal parts out the window into the roadside ditch. What remained of the CIA's most sophisticated agent communications device was scattered into the weeds. Tolkachev returned home. He took the CIA meeting schedule and copied it, using codes, into a magazine he kept at home, Nauka i Zhizhen, Science and Life, and then destroyed the original schedule, too. On April 28th, before going to work, Tolkachev took out the pen with the L-pill concealed inside and put it in his pocket so he could grab it quickly if needed. He thought to himself that the most likely place for his arrest would be Kurpachev's office. He figured he would be summoned, and as he opened the door, the KGB would pull his hands behind his back so he could not grab the pen. For the next several days, as a precaution, Tolkachev removed the fragile capsule from the pen and held it under his tongue every time Kurpachev summoned him to the office. The arrest never came. Tolkachev didn't signal the CIA at the time, but he wrote a long, detailed account about what happened, to pass at their next meeting in the autumn. He wrote that if the KGB already had his handwritten notes on the MiG-29 target recognition system, then no measures would help me. But, he added, if I successfully did away with my materials in time, then the KGB will not be able to find documentary evidence of my relationship with you. If the KGB was embarking on a broad search for the source of a leak, there was nothing in the house or at the dacha that would be compromising. After some time passed with no arrest, Tolkachev concluded that the KGB investigation was not focused directly on him. His panic subsided. But just to be safe, he decided to carry the L-pill in his pocket whenever he went to see the CIA case officer, and whenever carrying secret documents from work. Tolkachev was the Moscow station's crown jewel of human source intelligence collection, but the station had another top-secret asset, an espionage operation of a different kind. Not a human source, it was a machine, and another tangible sign of how far CIA intelligence collection had come in Moscow since the years of paralysis in the 1960s. The operation was codenamed CK Elbow, and it ranks as one of the most ingenious and daring of the Cold War. The heart of it was the underground wiretap on the sensitive data line running from the nuclear weapons facility at Troitsk to the Defense Ministry in Moscow. The CIA and the National Security Agency placed a listening tap on the cable by sneaking into one of the manholes along the route. All the case officers in Moscow had trained on the manhole mock-up back in the United States. David Rolfe had broken his thumb in the effort. Once the operation got underway, James Olson was the first to climb into the manhole in August 1979 for a survey and to take photographs. Later, a technical operations officer went down to test which of the lead-sheathed lines should be tapped. After that, another technical officer installed the actual wiretap. The CIA cleverly concealed the device so it could not be detected by routine maintenance workers. It began to suck out the data from the cable and transmit them to a recording device the CIA had buried between two trees, 12 feet away. Every once in a while, the Moscow station sent a case officer to swap out the recorder and collect the data, a mission undertaken with all the precautions of meeting a human spy. The recording device ran on its own power source and stored huge amounts of data until it was retrieved. To deter the curious, the CIA stuck a warning label on the recorder in Russian that said, "Danger, high voltage," and the recorder was protected by its own tamper-sensing alarm to silently warn a CIA case officer at a distance if anything had disturbed it. The operation cost the United States some $20 million. For all the technical wizardry, CK Elbow still required tending by people. On a pleasant Saturday in June 1983, it was up to Bob Morris to get the machine safely out of the ground and back to the station. Morris and his wife began the mission by carrying a box of sodas out to their car for a picnic in the countryside. Inside the box was concealed a plain backpack, and inside the backpack, the replacement recorder, a collapsible shovel, and animal repellent. After a long surveillance detection run, they took a bus, then a trolley, and began to hike by foot. Morris hefted the heavy backpack on his shoulders, and they both donned a light disguise to look more like Russians just out for fresh air. They walked during the afternoon until they reached two rows of trees, a windbreak, and, beyond the trees, an expansive field. Twilight was settling in. While his wife, who was also on a contract with the CIA, served as lookout, Morris searched for the spot, a break in one tree line, where the recorder was located. He had never been to the location before, but had studied satellite photographs. He found the recorder quickly and began to dig. His wife stood watch. Morris pulled the old recorder from the ground and was securing the new one when he suddenly saw his wife shudder, as if she were about to let out a scream. She gasped, and Morris turned his head sharply. He saw that two wild kittens had leaped out of the bushes and startled her. They were only weeks old and playful. Morris and his wife tried to remain silent and not break out laughing. Morris secured the new recorder in the hole, lodged in some animal repellent, connected the wires, and covered it. The animal repellent was to keep out rodents. The CIA experimented with using tiger feces, actually acquired in India, thinking that the scent of tigers might scare away any animal. It didn't work. The other animals didn't seem to care whether there was a tiger in the woods or not. Morris put the old recorder into the backpack and cleaned up the site to cover their tracks, and they retraced their steps. Bus, trolley, then, as they approached the parked car, they removed the disguises and changed back to their picnic clothes. Morris put the backpack and the old recorder into the soda box and closed it. And they drove home. He carried the soda box past the Soviet militiamen and up to his apartment. The next day, the old recorder was passed by others to the station. Morris breathed a deep sigh of relief. Nothing quite readied him for the stress and strain of working deep cover in Moscow. He had largely escaped notice by the KGB, but in the autumn of 1983, he began to come under more surveillance. The next scheduled meeting with Tolkachev was set for September 20th, but Morris had to abort because of surveillance. The Fortochka was open to signal for a meeting on October 4th, but Tolkachev did not show up. He signaled for a meeting on October 21st, but there was surveillance, and the CIA had to abort. Tolkachev signaled for a phone call as a precursor to a meeting on October 27th, and a case officer went out and called his apartment three times, but only reached his son and his wife. Again, on November 3rd, the Fortochka was open, but Tolkachev didn't show. Morris, still under deep cover, was growing frustrated. For each meeting, there was an alternate window of time, an hour later. Each time Tolkachev didn't show, Morris would leave, stay black for an hour, and return at the alternate time, but to no avail. Morris had gone through the long surveillance detection runs, his adrenaline was pumping, and then, nothing. There was no explanation. One missed meeting was understandable, but from September to November 1983, five attempts to meet Tolkachev had failed. Finally, on the evening of November 16th, Morris broke through. He met Tolkachev at the streetcar stop where they had first encountered each other. Both felt immensely relieved. As they walked toward Tolkachev's car, Morris asked about the missed meetings. Tolkachev explained that he had come twice but had not seen Morris. He said his wife had opened the Fortochka on three of the dates when he didn't show up. It was useless to use the telephone anymore, he said. Between his teenage son and his wife, the phone was constantly engaged, and in any case, there was no privacy. In the car, Tolkachev had no film and said security was still tied at work. It was all explained in his ops note, he said, but he would not attempt any document photography for a while. The two were thrilled to reconnect. Morris gave Tolkachev a package from the Moscow station that included two Tropel cameras, hidden in key fobs, and a new light meter. In a note, the CIA told Tolkachev that the tiny cameras had been improved somewhat to 25-foot candles of illumination. Morris didn't dwell on the packages. He wanted to know about Tolkachev's health and well-being. At the end of the meeting, Morris said, "I can't begin to tell you how happy I was to see you tonight." Tolkachev replied, "Yes, I feel exactly the same way." It was Tolkachev's 18th meeting with the CIA. The station was upbeat at first, in cables to headquarters. "Meeting went perfectly in all respects, and CK Sphere is fine," the station reported. The conversation during the meeting was lively and good-natured. CK Sphere seemed to be in a good mood. But the bad news came as soon as the ops note was translated. In the note, Tolkachev described in detail the scare of the spring, the investigation, burning everything in the dacha's iron stove, the poison pill under his tongue. The scare reignited all the old anxieties about Tolkachev. "It is painfully obvious," the station told headquarters, "that CK Sphere considers himself to be in great danger, and his security situation continues to deteriorate. We are certain you will be as stunned as we are after you read it." Tolkachev reported to the CIA that by autumn he had concluded that the KGB was carrying out a broad investigation, not directed specifically at him. Yet he felt it was possible they were still pursuing someone. Tolkachev said he was in a waiting position, and at least for a while could not bring the CIA any more material about the MiG-29 target recognition system. He reported that workers in the First Department had begun making unannounced spot checks in his laboratory to find out if secret documents were misplaced in any way. At the same time, all employees were asked to submit new photographs. A new building pass is in the works. In a tone that was apologetic, Tolkachev said, "I was forced to take maximum care in the emergency," and he was still not certain what triggered the investigation. He said he could provide no more documents until the next year. Tolkachev expressed a willingness to copy out passages of secret documents by hand, but that would not be easy. He had previously done the writing in the quiet of the Lenin Library after work, but lately he was too tired to go there in the evenings, and unable to explain to his family why he was late. With the spot checks by the First Department, he said, it was risky to copy secret information by hand into notebooks on his work desk. Tolkachev also revealed he was suffering from a new health problem. His broken nose from a hockey accident as a youth had not bothered him for years, but now he could barely breathe through his nose, and "it is beginning to make me very uncomfortable." It ruined his sleep and left him tired during the day. He warned the CIA that he might have an operation on his nose that would change his appearance, but they could recognize him by a familiar practice. Going to a meeting with a case officer, he said, "I will always hold in my left hand a light-colored book, usually white." The CIA was shocked by Tolkachev's account of the scare. Headquarters called it a chilling account, and added in a cable to the Moscow station, "We share your profound dismay and can only imagine the agony with which CK Sphere has lived since late April 1983. But there wasn't much they could do now. The next scheduled meeting was 5 months away in April 1984. The Moscow station said that perhaps they should instruct Tolkachev to bury his Tropel cameras, but Tolkachev no longer had any communications gear, so there was no easy way to get him a message, unless he called for or agreed to an unscheduled meeting before April. Had there been a leak? Headquarters insisted not. A check showed that the material on the target recognition system had not been disseminated inside the U.S. government until June, so it could not have caused the April investigation. 2 years earlier, in August 1981, the CIA had been alarmed about an article in Aviation Week and Space Technology, a magazine that enjoyed good sources in the U.S. government and among defense contractors. The article had taken note of significant gain in technology in Soviet military avionics. Quoting unidentified Navy intelligence officials, the magazine described long-range, look-down, shoot-down capability in a new fighter. But it seemed quite unlikely that this article had triggered a sudden security investigation in Tolkachev's institute 20 months later. The Tolkachev letter was given to a headquarters officer fluent in Russian, who had access to all the files and and was asked to interpret the state of the mind of the billion-dollar spy. The officer was impressed with Tolkachev's sense of mission and wrote, "There is no doubt whatsoever that C.K. Sphere suffered a shock after overhearing the conversations in the head designer's office, a severe shock in contemplating the imminent possibility of the KGB closing in. However, the shock seems to have sprung not so much from the presumed close brush with the termination of his life as with the termination of his life's project. Self-preservation per se does not appear to play any great role. In fact, in the very midst of his shock, he comes up with the firm resolve to undertake all measures not to fall into the hands of the KGB alive." According to the headquarters officer, Tolkachev was concerned not with saving himself, but with saving his espionage. A very practical and stubborn determination to weather out the storm and last as long as possible, in order to do as much damage as possible to the Soviet government. Tolkachev exhibits legendary resilience and strength, the officer observed. Despite the shocking nature of the events and actions that he's describing, his tone is quite positive and strong. He describes everything almost unemotionally, in a conversational style of narrative, as though talking about how he spent his vacation. The officer continued, "He approaches everything objectively, particularly his weaknesses. Although he believes that his conclusions were logical and justifiable, he does admit that his analysis of events was undoubtedly hasty, and further intensifies his self-judgment by underlining the words. He impartially dissects his analysis and shows how he was influenced by his one real fear into reaching a state of near panic. However, despite the fear and feeling of panic, his subsequent actions were a result of cool deliberation. Thus, C.K.'s fear destroyed all his equipment and incriminating material, not out of fear for his life, because that fear didn't exist, but as a deliberate attempt to deprive the KGB of even the slightest crumbs of satisfaction, aside from those that would inevitably fall their way once he was discovered." The officer added, "C.K.'s fear shows complete disregard for the fear of death, but he unhesitatingly exhibits his one real fear, to be caught by the KGB unawares." An intense hatred of the KGB permeates the description of all of C.K.'s fear's imaginary dealings with it. To this end, although he is forced to exercise restraint and lie low at the moment, it seems that C.K.'s fear has also resolved to go on and not to be caught alive. Chapter 16. Seeds of Betrayal. Thomas Mills was an experienced hand at clandestine operations. Balding and slender, known by many for his mild manner, Mills was chief of the CIA headquarters branch that handled espionage operations inside the Soviet Union. In addition to his other duties, he spent time getting to know young case officers in training before they left for Moscow duty. They usually came into the Soviet desk once a week or so to read the message traffic. Mills also participated in the training courses in surveillance and tradecraft for new generations of case officers. One evening in late May 1984, Mills and his wife Joby were entertaining diplomats from Eastern Europe as guests at their home in Vienna, Virginia. Mills heard an unexpected knock at the door and excused himself. At the door was Edward Lee Howard, his face flushed with anger. Howard was a trainee Mills had supervised on the Soviet desk in 1982 and 1983. Howard was preparing to go to Moscow, where he would become the next case officer to handle Tolkachev. But the CIA lost confidence in him, and he had been forced out of the agency. Mills walked out to the driveway, and he saw that Howard's wife Mary was with him, holding their toddler. A neighbor of Mills, who had been a trainee with Howard, was also there. Howard stood 5'11", with brown eyes and wavy black hair. His mood was dark and agitated. Mills could not invite Howard inside. It would disrupt the dinner. He told Howard it was not a good time to talk. Howard was brimming with resentment. He begged Mills to help him, to listen to him, perhaps to reverse the CIA's decision. Mills again said he could not talk. Howard shot back with profanity. The CIA had fucked him. Mary fought back tears. Mills went back inside, unsettled by the encounter. Howard had been a lousy trainee. Mills was glad he was not being sent to the Moscow station. The CIA wanted nothing more to do with Howard. The psychiatrists said there should be a clean break, no coddling, no hopes of return. Howard's appearance at the door was a bad sign. Howard possessed some of the CIA's deepest secrets. He washed out of the agency, and that was difficult enough. Now, he was becoming unhinged. Edward Lee Howard was an Air Force brat. His father was a sergeant, a technician on guided missile electronics, and his mother came from a Hispanic family with deep roots in western New Mexico. As a boy, Howard explored his grandfather's cattle ranch in Alamogordo while his father was serving abroad, and later he saw the world, moving with his parents every 2 or 3 years to a new military base. After graduating from the University of Texas with a business degree, he volunteered to serve in the Peace Corps in Colombia, although he wasn't particularly happy there. Howard subsequently worked for the Agency for International Development, managing loan programs in Peru. He received a master's in business administration from American University in Washington, and then became head of the Chicago office of an environmental consulting firm. In 1976, Howard married another Peace Corps volunteer, Mary Cedarleaf, whom he had met in Colombia. He was in a management position at his company, Ecology and Environment, Inc., and bought a house in the Chicago suburbs. Everything was fine, except Howard was bored. He drank too much and quarreled with Mary about the drinking. He longed to go back overseas. In 1979, he filled out a job application for the Central Intelligence Agency. He was 28 years old, had traveled the world, showed some language abilities, was of Hispanic descent, and worked in businesses. The CIA had broadened its recruiting beyond the Ivy League networks of the past, seeking to compete with private business for the best and brightest young people. Howard was put through a battery of exams and a security investigation. In December 1980, he was offered a position in the clandestine service. His interest was in economics, and he hoped to get a nice assignment in Europe, perhaps collecting economic intelligence in Switzerland. Howard reported for duty at CIA headquarters in January 1981 and passed a routine polygraph test. He acknowledged drinking and using cocaine and marijuana in Latin America, but this did not disqualify him. He was warned not to use drugs again, or he would be dismissed. Soon he was deeply enmeshed in the basic career trainee program, and appeared to be headed for Europe and a first assignment in East Germany. In February 1982, he was unexpectedly offered a position in Moscow. It is not known why, but the author David Wise suggests that another candidate had pulled out and Howard was a quick substitute. By his own account, Howard never had any interest in going to the Soviet Union, but he accepted the new assignment, figuring it would be a rung up the CIA career ladder for me. He began studying Russian at Georgetown University, and on Saturdays would go to CIA headquarters to read the message traffic. Howard was on the Soviet desk from February 7, 1982, until April 30, 1983. He had access to the day-to-day operational cables from the Moscow station, in which Tolkachev was identified as CK Sphere. It is not known whether Howard learned Tolkachev's true identity, but Howard was in the pipeline for Moscow, preparing to work with Tolkachev, so he might have read more deeply into the operation, including Tolkachev's 1978 letter to the CIA revealing his identity and profession. Mary also joined the CIA and went through the training courses. Her role in Moscow would be to support his operational forays, primarily as a lookout for surveillance. Both of them took the CIA's rigorous training in denied areas operations, learning how to detect and evade KGB surveillance. The course involved weeks of demanding exercises on the streets of Washington. FBI special agents posed as KGB surveillance teams, forcing the young case officers to sharpen their skills. Mills, who had gone through the exercises a generation earlier with his wife, sometimes participated in the training. He saw Howard in action one day and thought he was slow. Mills also noticed that Mary was shy and frightened. An exercise involving a simulated ambush by gun-wielding FBI officers reduced Mary to tears. Howard's training also included preparations for crawling into the manhole and servicing CK Elbow, the underground cable tap outside Moscow. The training involved a 10-mile hike with a 35-pound backpack to simulate the experience of replacing the data recorder clandestinely. Usually, for training, the backpack was weighted with stones, but Howard cheated, stuffing cardboard into the backpack instead. The incident was known to the trainers, but not reported to superiors at the time. Howard and his wife were also taught the jack-in-the-box procedure for escaping surveillance and practiced jumping from a car at just the right moment. Howard's jump was rehearsed on a grassy strip near the Kennedy Center in Washington. By early 1983, Howard seemed to be on track for Moscow. To improve his cover as a budget officer in the U.S. Embassy, he took a course sponsored by the State Department to train diplomats. He received a commission signed by President Reagan and Secretary of State George Shultz, dated March 11, 1983, confirming he was a new officer of the U.S. Diplomatic Service. That same month, his first child, a son, Lee, was born. The family's passports were sent away for multiple-entry diplomatic visas to the Soviet Union. They were scheduled to leave for Moscow in late June. For the CIA, Howard was to be a deep-cover officer, a rookie selected in part because he was young and clean, and would hopefully be overlooked by the KGB. Before leaving, Howard was required to take a routine lie detector test. After the test was conducted in April, he recalled, the examiner shook his hand and wished him well. But there were anomalies in the results that caught the attention of security officials. Howard was asked to take a second polygraph. The results indicated deception about some crime in his past. Howard admitted that once, when drunk, he had filched $40 from a cosmetic kit left on the seat next to him by an airline passenger. He was asked to take a third polygraph, and was so nervous about it that he swallowed a tranquilizer beforehand, infuriating the examiner. Then he was asked to take a fourth lie detector test on April 29th. The tests repeatedly showed deception about some criminal act, and, in Howard's responses, to questions about drug and alcohol abuse. Within days, the CIA decided not to send Howard to Moscow, and a panel of top agency officials was convened to decide his fate. The CIA could have sidelined him into a non-sensitive job, but instead, the panel decided he should be immediately forced out. David Forden, who was chief of the division while Howard was in training, recalled that the panel on which he served made a quick decision, describing Howard as a loser. Forden added, "I said, let's get rid of this guy. He was a bum." On May 3rd at headquarters, Howard was told he would not be going to Moscow. He was presented with an ultimatum: resign from the CIA or be fired. The CIA did not explain why. His wife Mary, then on maternity leave as a CIA employee, demanded to know why, and the CIA would not say. Howard told his wife, "They were convinced I was lying." He was correct. The CIA did not think they could trust a trainee who had just failed four consecutive polygraph tests with their most sensitive operations in the Soviet Union. The CIA director has the power to unilaterally remove the security clearances of an employee, effectively ending his or her employment. Howard signed the resignation paper. But before he could be escorted out of headquarters, He made a photocopy of his CIA access badge, bearing his photograph and a number, and copied some notes to take with him. The CIA said he would be kept on the payroll for 6 weeks and should visit the agency's senior psychiatrist, Bernard Malloy, and report for a physical examination. The agency also prepared a resume he could use for future employers, saying he had spent 2.5 years as a Foreign Service officer at the State Department. It didn't mention the CIA. Howard was dumbfounded. He later recalled, "I was disoriented by the way they had pulled the rug out from under me, and angered by the callous way they had fired me and thrown me out on the street." He decided to return to New Mexico, and he managed to get a job with the Legislative Finance Committee of the state legislature as an economics analyst, estimating oil and gas revenues. Howard told people who asked that he was being prepared for an assignment in Moscow by the State Department, but did not want to go with a baby, so he had quit. He bought an adobe-style ranch house at 108 Verano Loop in El Dorado, south of Santa Fe, and prepared to pick up the pieces and start a new life, Mary recalled. Howard had signed a secrecy oath and was expected to keep his secrets forever, even after being forced out of the CIA. The CIA could end his employment, but had no power to carry out law enforcement inside the United States. If Howard became a security risk, that was a counterintelligence matter, under the purview of the FBI. At the time, the CIA did not inform the FBI that a trainee who had access to secret operational files had been forced out. The CIA's approach was to keep its troubles in the family. However, even if the CIA had alerted the FBI at this point, it is not clear the Bureau would have taken any action. Howard was seething, gripped by a desire to exact revenge on the CIA. In the weeks after he was forced out, he walked into the consulate of the Soviet Union, located on Phelps Place, northwest, in the Colorama neighborhood of Washington, and left a note on the desk of the receptionist. The note was signed Alex. It also contained the photocopy of his CIA badge, mentioned that he had been headed to the Moscow station, and said he had information to sell for $60,000. Howard left instructions for meeting him at some later date at the U.S. Capitol, and he included a random number code. Howard told his wife, Mary, that it was safer to leave a note at the consulate than at the Soviet embassy, located on 16th Street Northwest, because there were no FBI security cameras monitoring the consulate, as at the embassy. Howard set the meeting with the Soviets for an upstairs bathroom at the Capitol on October 20, 1983. From his training, he knew the FBI is prohibited from entering the Capitol. They could not spot him there. The Capitol also offered many areas thronged with tourists. Howard spent several hours sitting outside the Soviet consulate, in a park, pondering what to do, but eventually decided against going to the Capitol for the meeting. On coming home, he told Mary that he just could not do it. Viktor Cherkashin, the second-ranking KGB officer in Washington at the time, said the KGB had received Howard's letter, but also decided not to go to the Capitol meeting, fearing that it might be an FBI setup. Howard began making strange phone calls to Moscow. Late at night, often drunk, he called a U.S. phone number he had learned at the CIA, a special tie line to the Moscow embassy that allowed diplomats to make calls back and forth to the United States without going through decrepit Soviet landlines. The tie line was not secure, probably monitored by the KGB, and intended for personal calls and official calls that were routine. One evening, when it was already morning the next day in Moscow, Howard called the embassy, and a Marine guard answered the line. Howard began reeling off a series of numbers from a sheet of paper, and then hung up. Another time, he identified himself by name and asked to leave a message for the Moscow station chief that he was not showing up for his physical. There was no reason for Howard to make the call about his physical. The station chief already knew he wasn't coming. The chief reported the call to headquarters, which summoned Howard and lectured him about the calls. In fact, Howard was attempting to use the phone line to alert the KGB. My call to the CIA station chief about the physical effectively revealed to the Soviets that my job was to have been a deep-cover CIA officer. Howard later wrote, saying he made that call deliberately and in anger. Another time, Howard used the phone to call Moscow and ask for Raya, a tall, blonde Russian woman who worked in the U.S. Embassy, in charge of such things as getting visas for diplomats, housing, and hiring Soviet employees. She told embassy officials about the call, and undoubtedly told the KGB, too. The important thing was to let them know how he could be located, said one CIA official who reviewed the record. Howard was being very cool, operationally. In the fall of 1983, Howard wrote an open letter to the Soviet consulate in San Francisco. The letter appeared to be an ordinary one from a citizen, expressing concern about U.S.-Soviet relations. Howard signed his own name. He told Mary that he wrote it as a tease, assuming that the CIA or the FBI would see it and become upset at his direct contact with the Soviets. Howard's drinking grew worse. He was drunk on February 26, 1984, when he confronted three strangers at a bar outside Santa Fe, New Mexico. Howard, who owned firearms and had a license to buy and sell guns, kept a Smith & Wesson .44 Magnum revolver under the seat of his Jeep. He provoked a confrontation with the strangers, and at one point aimed the gun through the open window of their vehicle. When one of them pushed it away, the gun fired through the roof. They attacked Howard and seized the weapon. No one was injured by the gunfire, but Howard was beaten and spent a night in jail. He later pleaded guilty to three counts of assault with a deadly weapon and was fined $7,500, ordered to see a psychiatrist, and given 5 years probation. His state of mind was clearly unsettled. He had come out to New Mexico optimistic about starting over, perhaps even running for political office. But Mary recalled that after the drunken brawl, he gave up hope. He began talking about going to the Soviets. In May 1984, Burton Gerber, who had been Moscow chief of station from 1980 to 1982, and who had been at the forefront of a generation of officers who pushed for more aggressive methods to spy on the Soviet Union, was appointed chief of the Soviet division. Soon after, the Edward Lee Howard mess fell into his lap. Gerber had not hired Howard or fired him, but now he faced the question of what to do about him. The confrontation with Mills on the driveway was a bad sign. From reading the file and talking to people, Gerber learned that the agency's psychiatrist had insisted on cutting off all contact with Howard after he had been forced out. Gerber concluded that was a mistake. If Howard possessed sensitive information, then they should not give him the cold shoulder. When Howard applied for reimbursement for half of his psychiatric counseling bills, saying his troubles were caused by his time in the CIA, Gerber approved the payments. In September 1984, two CIA officials flew to Santa Fe to check up on Howard. They were Mills, the Soviet branch chief, and Malloy, the agency psychiatrist. At a breakfast meeting in a local motel, Howard seemed to be on the rebound and getting his life back together again. He showed up well-dressed, seeming optimistic about his future. The CIA officials told Howard that his counseling bills would be paid by the CIA. During the conversation, Howard made a startling admission. He told the CIA officials he had stopped in the park outside the Soviet consulate and pondered what would happen if he went inside. Howard said he figured the Soviets were cheap, would not give him much money, and in the end, he said he decided not to do it. He was lying. He had already done much more. Just days before the breakfast, Howard returned from a trip to Europe with his family. The CIA had inadvertently mailed Howard his family's diplomatic passports after he was forced out. He used them for the trip. Howard and his family visited Italy, Switzerland, Germany, and Austria. One night in Milan, quite drunk, Howard disappeared from his family around midnight and returned at 4 a.m. He was stopped on the way home by a police officer who noticed he was drunk. Howard showed his diplomatic passport and was released. During those hours, he probably made contact with the KGB. It is not known precisely what occurred, but Howard later boasted to a friend that Milan had been a cover for action to meet the Soviets, and he had filled a dead drop there. Mary did not see anything unusual on the trip. Howard had only just begun. In October 1984, he received a phone call at home from a man with a soft, pleasant voice and a slight accent. The man inquired about a manuscript that Howard was offering to sell, and by the way the question was asked, Howard realized he was referring to the letter he had left at the Soviet consulate in 1983. Howard replied that he had nothing to sell and not to call him again. But the man was persistent. He said he could make things very unpleasant for Howard or could make things very good for him. He said he might be willing to pay twice Howard's suggested price of $60,000. The caller told Howard to think about it, and he would call again at a later date. Cherkashin, the second-ranking KGB man in Washington, wrote in his memoir that he made the call, and Howard expressed enthusiasm about the prospect of working for us, Cherkashin added. I told him he'd have to travel to Vienna to meet his handler, and that we'd contact him later to inform him when and how to go there. He agreed. After the call, Howard sent a postcard to the Soviet consulate in San Francisco, signed Alex. It was intended to confirm plans for a January 1985 meeting in Vienna. He received a second call around a month later about the trip. Howard told Mary, I'm going to get those bastards at the CIA. I'm going to hurt them like they've never been hurt before. Chapter 17 Vanquish. For Tolkachev, the security scare at his institute had been a jolt. A year later, he was still turning over in his mind what had happened. When he met a CIA case officer on the street the evening of April 19, 1984, Tolkachev passed a 13-page ops note, saying he was sorry for having panicked. Today, sorting in my mind all the events that occurred in late April 1983, I must admit that my actions were too hasty, he wrote. He apologized again for having destroyed so much at that time, and for not having passed any new information for a whole year. Tolkachev gave the CIA officer 26 pages of notes and schematics on Soviet radars, which he had handwritten from memory, and returned two fully exposed Tropel cameras. He told a case officer that the security situation at the Institute hadn't changed and was still very restrictive, although there had not been any surprise inspections since the previous autumn. He wasn't sure if this was an ominous sign or if the danger had passed. He wrote that it was possible the KGB knew of a leak, but lacked enough details to track it down. Or perhaps the KGB was just preparing lists of who knew what, so they could pounce when the time was right. The meeting was the first contact with the Moscow station since the previous autumn, when Tolkachev had revealed the scare. Out of touch for months, the CIA was worried about his frame of mind, and in an ops note, reassured Tolkachev that he had done the right thing. You have reacted to a dangerous situation with great courage, realistic caution, and admirable self-control, they wrote. We understand your desire to leave nothing for the KGB and completely agree with your decision to destroy all evidence of your link to us. Then, to put your mind at ease about security, the CIA gave Tolkachev a separate memo from headquarters that described how his materials were handled in the United States. The memo said that from the very start of the operation, the CIA had established special procedures, including secure locations to store the files in the few agencies that received the intelligence. And no other material except yours can be kept in these repositories. Neither the material itself nor excerpts from it can be taken out of the repositories. Each person who read the material had to sign his name. In this way, we can always know who reads